I think the first thing I wanted to start with today was a discussion of the kinetic versus thermodynamic lab. So we are going to have that kinetic versus thermodynamic topic on the lab quiz, but since that's not for a little while still, I'll wait to review that topic until a bit later. But as far as the lab itself, let's talk about the results and let's remind ourselves what it is that we were investigating. So we had these two different starting materials, cyclohexanone and 2-furaldehyde. Is either one of those compounds aromatic? Now, you have a quiz today, so that kind of question I would have hoped would have provoked a more immediate response. Is either one of those compounds aromatic? Or are you confused by the carbonyl being conjugated with the ring? Realize that that from what we've learned so far at least, anything that's outside of the ring is not going to have an influence on aromaticity. So the fact that we have a carbonyl that's in conjugation is going to influence that ring, but it's not going to cause or prevent it from being aromatic. So I'll ask the question again. Is either one of those compounds aromatic? Yes, it is. Maybe in this section I hadn't come back to talk about furan and thiophene. Is thiophene a term that you remember hearing before? No. All right. So I'll make sure to do that when we get to lecture after the quiz. So obviously that example is not on the quiz, but just like in pyrrole, remember pyrrole is the 5-membered ring with a nitrogen where the lone pair ends up being part of that ring, even though on paper it looks like it's sp3, and that's because it ends up being really favorable for the lone pair to delocalize because it comes aromatic once it does so. Same thing happens in a molecule like furan. So remember that this portion of the molecule, this ring portion, furan, one of the two lone pairs will delocalize the same way as it does in pyrrole. So it's actually kind of an in-between case or a combination of the cases of pyridine and pyrrole. Because in pyridine we have a lone pair that's not part of the cycle, and that's why it's aromatic. And in pyrrole, we do have a lone pair that's part of the cycle, and that's why it's aromatic. And here for furan, we have both. One that would be part of the aromatic system, one that would be perpendicular to it. So that second compound, yes, is aromatic. Does that have an activator or deactivator substituted on it? A deactivator, because we have a carbonyl which is electron withdrawing. So, back onto the lab though. I just wanted to bring some of this up since we have covered aromatic material now. But the point of the lab wasn't that, it was that we were going to make derivatives. And so there's this semi-carbazone. That we reacted it with. Did we discuss why it is that it's the leftmost nitrogen of this compound that ends up being the one that reacts? Well, whether we did or did not, can anyone come up with a rational explanation why it is, the way that I've written at least, the leftmost nitrogen that is the most reactive, the one that becomes part of that derivative? Or another way to say it is the lone pair that is next to the carbonyl is too involved with delocalization. So in fact, nitrogens like that, the ones right next to the carbonyl, are unusually non-basic. Nitrogen compounds usually are basic. Those are not, though, at least ones with nitrogens right next door to a carbonyl, because of how much involvement there is in delocalization of that lone pair with the carbonyl. So we get two products, which are called semi-carbazones, which are a bit like hydrazones, which is the same type of functional group, except that we use the molecule hydrazine as one of our starting materials instead. Now, we had the reference melting points that we looked up, and if I recall, it was the cyclohexanone that was 166, was it? The reference, and then 202 for the other one, I think it was?
Okay.
The reason we needed those melting points is we were doing a series of experiments to try to figure out which one of these two products is the thermodynamic product and which one is the kinetic product. So there is some kind of competition, and there must be the same type of situation then as we saw with 1,2 versus 1,4 addition. In other words, whichever one of these two is the thermodynamic product is the one that's more thermodynamically stable, but must have a larger activation barrier to being formed. Whereas the one that is the kinetic product, the one that's not as favorable thermodynamically, but it's called the kinetic product because it must have a smaller activation barrier. Now, if you can recall that lecture, which I know it's been a few days now, where we discussed kinetic versus thermodynamic control, it was all about those activation barriers. Because at low temperature, where you don't really have much energy, first of all, to get over the reaction barrier in the forward direction, and reverse reactions are very unlikely, because in an exothermic process, at least, reverse reactions require even more activation energy than forward reactions. So at low temperatures, it's going to be which one of those activation barriers is lower to begin with that's going to decide which product forms. And that's why at low temperatures, it is the kinetic product that tends to dominate. Versus at high temperatures, you've got, one, more energy to try to get over the barrier, and two, more energy for the reaction to be reversible. So suppose you made the kinetic product at first. It would be possible for that product to revert and then have another chance to make the thermodynamic product, which once you make that product, is the least likely of any of the products or reactants to do anything, because it's at the lowest energy of any of the molecules involved. So, at high temperatures, we expect the thermodynamic product to form. Now, one important point that we have to start out with, the fact that one of these compounds has a lower melting point than the other has nothing to do with which one is the thermodynamic product or the kinetic product. Because melting point is just a matter of intermolecular forces, how molecules end up being attracted to each other. That's a separate issue from how the molecule was formed. And these are not isomers. Well, No, they're not, because we have two oxygens and one, only one oxygen the other. We do have six carbons on each, but we only have one, two, what is that? Four hydrogens on that one, so not isomers. Can't do a direct energy comparison. But, so 166 does not mean that is the kinetic product, and 202 does not mean that's the thermodynamic product. Maybe I should write that down just so we're sure of that. Now, what were your melting points like for part A and for part B? Did you get roughly 166 or anything approaching that for part A? And did you get anything approaching 202 for part B? Yes. So, fairly close for A, but not so close for B. Okay, anybody else? Yeah.
B, I got 197.
A little closer. Okay.
First A, I got 169.
Still relatively close. Anybody else? Yes. A, 194. Okay, so... We don't know for sure why the melting points seem to be coming out a little bit low in most of these cases. I mean, one of the most likely reasons is just the way that it was measured. The fact that you didn't want to wait 5 hours for the temperature to just crawl up as slowly as it should to get that more accurate measurement. Or maybe there was some impurity. Maybe we should have recrystallized, even though I think the procedure said don't bother. If only for part A and for part B to make sure we had those correct comparison temperatures. And the reason we did part A and part B is before we're trying to analyze a competition, a mixture that's resulting from a competition, we better know that we can figure out which one is which separately. So at least, though, there was a large difference in the melting points from part A to part B. And hopefully that means that when we start discussing part C, we're going to have the right result. Because what should be the result in part C? Well, you had below room temperature, and above room temperature reactions, correct? Or was it room temperature a little above and way above? It was below, at, and above. Okay. So below room temperature, that's the situation where you don't have much energy, so you don't have the kinetic product that should form, maybe not exclusively. That's the tricky thing about this. Maybe it's not exclusive, but the major product that would form. Versus room temperature, where maybe we're going to see a mixture of the two. And then at elevated temperature, we should see the thermodynamic product. Now, I think we discussed last quarter why it is that if we have one substance, that if we put another substance into it, it's going to cause potentially the melting point to drop what you would observe. Can anybody recall why that is? Because I would prefer to more... not skip over it, but kind of skim through that topic today, if possible, only because I want to make sure we get to more NMR today. Make sure we get through as much of that as we can before the lab lecture. So, what about those of you who had me for 1B before, where I know that was for a whole week we did nothing but talk about things like that? Oh dear. Then let's put some of those brain cells together and come up with a reasonable explanation, because what is it that causes a solid to melt in the first place? So, intermolecular forces, not weakening per se, but you have energy to overcome those intermolecular forces. So molecules, this is 1B all over again. Molecules don't necessarily have bonds break, they just have attractions that break. Those attractions are there regardless of temperature, but with temperature, enough temperature, you make the molecules vibrate enough that they separate from each other. Well, what if those molecules never had the ability to pack together as well as they could have in the first place? In other words, when they formed a solid, if you only had one substance, they should ideally arrange themselves into some particular pattern. But if you put some impurity in there, that's going to prevent those substances from aligning as well. And therefore, it's going to be easier to overcome the intermolecular forces, which means it melts at a lower temperature. Which that could happen in this lab. That's why when you learned it last quarter, you really needed to know it still this quarter. Because if we're doing melting point analysis, that tells us something about purity. Or the fact that if we had, let's say... 95% of the cyclohexanone derivative and 5% of the other one, you might end up with a melting point that is below 166. So in part C, that's the whole point of the story, did anybody end up with melting points that were significantly lower than 166? Okay. Now, I only see 3 or 4 hands up. Do I need to collect lab books to make sure that everybody did the lab to make sure you're not just going to be making up results? Because if I'm not getting more melting point temperatures, that might be what I have to do, because I'm concerned that no one else is participating. But either you don't care, which I can accept that, or you didn't do the lab, which I can't accept. So which of the two is it? In other words, could the rest of you please check and see what your lab C, your part C results were? Anybody else with melting points lower than 166 for part C? Okay, a few of you. So that might be due to this mixed melting point effect. Which temperature that you did the reaction at did you find those melting points below 166? Was it when you did the below room temperature, or was it when you did the above room temperature, the elevator point? Or is it the one when you did the one in the middle? Middle? The low and the middle? All three, okay? Middle. So more of you, it's the middle. Some of you had all three doing something strange. Okay, let me ask you this. Out of the three things that you did in part C, at which temperature of doing the experiment did you get the highest melting point? The high temperature? You all got the high temperature at the high melting point? Well, high temperature, melting point, means you've got more of the furaldehyde derivative. But if you were at high temperature when you did that, then that would mean that's the thermodynamic product. Because if you got your highest temperature measurement when you did the high temperature of reaction, then what about your lowest melting points? Were those for when you did the first one, the below room temperature run? Yes? That's what, in the middle one. But usually for most of you, the low or the middle temperature is where you've got your lowest melting point. Well, that means the cyclohexanone is the kinetic product. And that's the result we're trying to get from part C. So let me write up the logic behind this. Now, let me ask this first. Although I did teach this before, I'll write it down again if you want me to, or if you're able to just go back and study it, then for time's sake, I'll skip over it. But do I need to write down the discussion of reduced melting points doing to have mixtures? Sounds familiar enough? Okay. So, here's the large logic behind part C. When the reaction is conducted at low temperature, the kinetic product should predominate. While at elevated or high temperature, the thermodynamic product should predominate. So, whichever of the two reference compounds has the melting point that most closely matches the melting point obtained at the low temperature experiment is the kinetic product. And whichever one of those reference compounds has the melting point that more closely matches the melting point of the experiment when you did it at high temperature, that is the thermodynamic product. Sounds like they just turned the vacuum on.
Yay.
Now, the difference between Part C and Part D was just pH, which I don't even want to get into. It's not that it's not important, it's just not important at this level of OCHEM. So Part E, though, what was the point of that? Well, you had two competition reactions that you set up. Which, it's easier just to write out what's around. Even though this will take just a moment. Oh, darn. I just wrote the same thing twice. There we go. Voices coming from up above, aren't there? It's not just me hearing them. It might be, but that's a separate issue. No, I think the people working on the vacuum system are walking around up here. Anyways, a lot of writing to get at what's a relatively simple idea. We have one of the original starting materials and the other starting material's derivative. We put the two together and see if there's a reaction where the derivative undoes itself, and the other starting material that hadn't been derivatized yet instead becomes the derivative. What's the point of doing this? Well, we kind of already know what the answer is here. The lower melting point compound, the cyclohexanone derivative, if that's the one that formed primarily at the low temperature reaction, which we again say that because that melting point more closely matches the melting point we got from that mixture, well, then it's the kinetic product, which means that it would not really want to stick around as that derivative if we were to raise the temperature and allow the reaction to reverse. So the furaldehyde derivative, that is the thermodynamic product, that's the one that's going to stick around, even if you allow the reaction to reverse. So what's going on in this first reaction is I have what would form the kinetic product reacting with the thermodynamic product. The thermodynamic product does not want to reverse, and so what we should have seen is there should have been no change in melting point from the mixture to start with or end with in Part E for that particular reaction, because there should not have been a reverse reaction. But the bottom case, where we take the kinetic product and react with what could become the thermodynamic product, well, it would want to become the thermodynamic product if you're at higher temperatures. And so you should have a reaction, which means the melting point should change because we changed which compounds were around. And let me write down a brief summary. And these competition reactions whichever reaction involves the thermodynamic product should not occur. Since the thermodynamic product is unlikely to reverse. And then a similar statement I could make about the kinetic. The kinetic should be the one reverse if you're at higher temperature, because that's the point of what the kinetic product is. Now in part E, did your data at all support this? That nothing should have happened when we take the cyclohexane known with a furaldehyde derivative, but we should see a change when we take the furaldehyde and react it with the cyclohexanone derivative. What did you see? Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. You never got crystals, okay? And then part B. High melting point, which would match it not reacting, because that had the higher melting point to start with. So not great results, but it doesn't at least doesn't contradict what we would want to see. How about somebody else's results? Yes. Yes.
I got crystals, but I lost them somehow.
Oh dear. Okay. So now, the second one that was listed in the experiment, or listed as the reactions? Because I think I have these backwards in terms of the order the experiment was done in, right? I think the way your experiment was written, you actually took the cyclohexanone derivative first. So yours is the same reaction then where you saw the higher melting point, this first one as written. So that, again, backs up the fact that that's the kinetic product, because if the melting point was still the highest one, that means it didn't really react. This is what I want you to discuss in your lab report, or if you didn't get data that can support any of these results, like if your melting points are all horrible, we'll give you results, talk about how you can or cannot make any conclusions based on your results. You do need to see that at the low temperature reaction, you should have gotten a lower temperature melting point, higher temperature reaction, higher temperature melting point, which, one last time, that's a coincidence. In other words, we could have had an example where the low temperature reaction has the highest temperature melting point for some other kind of case. And the reverse, at high temperature, maybe we could have ended up with the lower melting point. That would have been possible, but it shouldn't have. The real results in this particular example are lowest melting point, lowest temperature reaction. Highest melting point, highest temperature reaction. So you need to have your data support that, or if it doesn't, then briefly discuss why you didn't get those kinds of results. Same thing for part E. Like in Natalie's case, she got some data that does seem to support the conclusion. As written, the first reaction here produced a product that had a high melting point, which again would indicate that a kinetic product failed to thermodynamic product failed to reverse. But if, again, your data don't support that, then discuss briefly why you think your data came out poorly. And then you don't need to, if your data didn't work, go too much into depth of what should have happened. Even if you did get your results, you only need to briefly explain why that supports your conclusion, because you're going to have a lab quiz question that's going to get into how would you describe what happened. So your lab report be complete, meaning talk about your data, talk about why you might have gotten poor data, and do relate those data to your results, but don't go on and on for paragraphs about it. Just make a, like, you don't have to justify or explain what is kinetic versus thermodynamic control. Because again, you'll have a chance to talk about that at the end of the course. Now this lab report I'm going to make due, not this upcoming Tuesday, but the Tuesday after that. So questions about the lab report. And then next lab lecture on Tuesday of next week, I'll come back to the simpler labs of the Wittig and the Grignard lab. Neutron. Today is supposed to be the last day, but how many of you still have lots of melting points to do? Not too many, though. Okay. So how many of you were able to get a melting point from your Diels-Alder lab? Did this section started with the Diels-Alder lab already on Tuesday, correct? So, not melting point, IR is what I meant. How many of you have been able to get an IR yet? Okay, so you do need time to do your IRs today. So, just IR for the newest lab, for the Diels-Alder lab, just IR. Now, we're not quite done yet this morning, though. Because even though you need that time for the IR, we really got to go forward a little bit in NMR. So let's move on to NMR for right now then. And maybe I'll do, maybe because of the low time, I'll switch the order that I was going to do these topics in. Okay, so let's do an alkyl halide example. And I forgot to bring one in here with me, so could I again borrow someone's lab text to look up the chemical shifts we're going to need? Which, yes, again, for a quiz, I would give you relevant chemical shift data. You do not need to memorize anything like that at this point. So, we have a chlorine. So we might want to know that when we have a chlorine right next door, average chemical shift is 3.5. Now let me look at the answer and see if I'm happy with that. Yes. So a hydrogen right next door to a chlorine is about 3.5. Hydrogen one more position away. Let's see if I can find that really quickly. Probably, it doesn't list it here, but it's probably more like 1.5, 1.7. I'm going to have to make a better chart. Oh, here we go. For bromide, it's 1.7. So for chloride, it's probably 1.5, 1.7 as well. So, useful information. Hydrogen right next to chlorine, 3.5. Hydrogen one more position away from chlorine, let's call it 1.7. So, what's the structure of this compound? Take another 60 seconds and try to grapple with it. See what you can come up with. Take the same approach as we did the other day, though. Meaning start with degree of unsaturation first to see if that gives us any useful information. Now, I'm starting with this problem because there's going to be, again, a series of small tricks we could use to jump to the answer. And there's, in fact, three different ways we could approach the answer here. So just, again, to make sure we're on the right track, what is the degree of unsaturation for this compound? Well, how many hydrogens should this compound have if all it had was carbon and hydrogen? 12. 5 times 2 plus 2 is 12. It only has 11, though. But that makes sense, because remember that if you put a halogen onto carbon, there is the effective removal of a hydrogen from that place. So this has 0 degrees of unsaturation, which means no rings, no double bonds. That's good to know. So, what does the chemical shift information tell you? Which this is going to be the first approach I use to solving the problem. What does the chemical shift information tell you? So, does it appear that we have any hydrogens on a carbon that is the same carbon the chlorine is attached to? Doesn't look like it, does it? Because look at the two chemical shift pieces of information there. On the carbon, right where the chlorine is, should be more like 3.5. Somewhere between 3 and 4, more generally, we could say. One more position away, then we get something like 1.7, which is what we've got. So the chemical shift appears to indicate there are no hydrogens on the same carbon as the chlorine. Which means there's only one answer possible for this compound. Why? Because there has to be the carbon where the chlorine is located. And if there's no hydrogens where that chlorine is, then in all directions, there must only be carbons. Let me write that down. A slightly shorter way to say it is that the carbon that chlorine is attached to must be quaternary. Because that's the only way to make it with no hydrogens. Well, how many carbons have I used up so far? 4 total. The center one plus the 3 others. There's only one other carbon in this compound. It doesn't matter which one of those groups I put it on. You'd get the same compound. There's the answer. Okay, I can tell if you're below because I might want to repeat what the logic was behind this. So, chemical shift, nothing above 2 even, which seems to mean that there's no carbon that has the hydrogen on the same carbon as the chlorine. If that's true, then structurally, there can't be any hydrogens there. And the only way to prevent that, then, is to have carbons at every place where you could have something next door. Now, those carbons are going to have hydrogens, which is fine. But they're a lower chemical shift because they're further away from chlorine, which that matches the data that we're given. Based on the size of the molecule, the fact that we only had five carbons to begin with, once we knew that the point of attachment for chlorine had to have three other carbons around it, which means we've used up four of the five carbons. And since at that point the molecule would have been symmetric, it wouldn't have mattered where I attached the fifth carbon, the result would have been the same. And therefore, this is the only possible answer. But what if we took a different approach? Because in one of the examples we did Tuesday, symmetry ended up being an issue, didn't it? We have an integration of 6, which means there's 2 possibilities as far as what the structure might look like. What are those 2 possibilities? Two of them are methyl groups, so 2 carbons that have 3 hydrogens that are equivalent. Or what technically would be the other possibility? If you could have 2 times 3, couldn't you have 3 times 2? So you could, in theory, have 3 carbons, each of which having 2 hydrogens that are all equivalent. But with a molecule with only 5 carbons, is that likely to be the case? Probably not, but let's write that down. So, given the small number of atoms in the compound, much more likely it's 2 carbons, each with 3 hydrogens, so 2 methyl groups. So if we had 2 methyl groups that were attached to the same place, then we can have this much of the structure be true, a carbon with 2 methyl groups coming off of it. But now let's use just one of the pieces of information that's given to us. Let me scoot this back down. We have something that integrates to 6. What's it splitting? A singlet. So how many neighbors do those 6 hydrogens have? None. The peak that integrates to 6 is also a singlet, so those hydrogens have no neighbors. Which means what? Which again means we have a structure where it's shown us we have a quaternary carbon, or at least we have a carbon that has no hydrogens on it. I should be a little more careful to say that. Now, there's only two possible structures that could result then. I could leave it like this and have just carbons attached all to that one position and put the chlorine here. Or, again, have something besides hydrogen attached to all positions, but have the chlorine attached closer to where those 6 hydrogens are. Now, how many different types of hydrogens are there in the first of these possibilities? How many unique NMR signals would be generated? 2. In the second compound, how many different types of hydrogens are there? 3. So, again, the first one only has 2 signals, which means it's the wrong one. The second one has 3 signals, which means it's the correct compound. So it's a different approach, where we started with the idea of symmetry. We started with the idea we have something integrates to 6, which means we have to have some kind of symmetry in there somewhere. Now, there's another way we could have done this. Which is to focus on the splitting patterns that we have. Because, for example, we could look at the fact there's a triplet that integrates to 3. The fact that it integrates to 3, of course, is separate from the fact that it's a triplet. We have the number 3 showing up in 2 places, but it's for 2 different reasons. If we have an integration of 3, that means we have a methyl group. But what does the triplet mean? There's only 2 neighbors, okay? But what is the splitting for the only peak that integrates to 2? Quartet. Not a quartet of doublets or a quartet of anything, just a quartet. So if you look at those 2 hydrogens that were causing the triplet, how many neighbors can be to the right of that position? Well, to the left, we already have 3 neighbors. That's what causes the quartet. So to the right, how many neighbors can we have? 0. Which means there's only 1 way we could make this compound. We have to put the other 3 connections at that point, make them carbons or chlorines, because it's the only way to avoid hydrogen. And when we do that, we use up all the carbons and chlorines, and again, we've solved the structure of the compound. So those 2 hydrogens cause a triplet. These hydrogens are only split into a quartet. So they only have neighbors on one side. Which means we can't have hydrogens at that end position. Which again means there's only one possible structure for this compound. So did anybody get the structure of the compound or get close? Oh, okay. Now, I know you have the quiz today, but if it's not becoming obvious that you need to do some of this practice, then maybe some more of the example problems we do next time will scare you into doing a little more study. I have one more example that I know we're going a little bit over, but we got to get this in. We have to get through this material. But this will be an easier problem. This compound has the formula C8H10 and only has two absorbances, 7.04 with an integration of a singlet, with a splitting of a singlet that integrates to 4, and then 2.296 that's also just a singlet that integrates to 6. So far, the only thing with a chemical shift that's that large that we've talked about is an aldehyde, or I did mention offhand that a carboxylic acid could also have a chemical shift that high. But let's see if we might guess something about the structure here. Because what's the degree of unsaturation? 4. That's pretty high, isn't it? Can we think of any type of molecule that we've studied so far that would have such a high degree of unsaturation? Maybe one that you'd be concerned about on the quiz. Ah, but we can't have an aldehyde because we don't have an oxygen. Don't have enough carbons for... Well, yeah, we do. We do have enough carbons for that, but... How about benzene itself, as far as a degree of unsaturation of 4? Because you have 3 double bonds, at least on paper, plus it's a ring. Remember that the ring itself counts as a degree of unsaturation. Benzene compounds have protons that show up generally between 7 and 8, sometimes a little lower than that for certain functional groups, but on average between 7 and 8. And minimum degree of unsaturation you have to have a benzene-based compound is 4. So again, 7 to 8 is the general range for chemical shift of benzene protons. Why is this true? My apologies to any physics instructors that might be listening, because it's been long enough that I can't really explain this as well as I'd like to. So I'm going to have to use the assistance of those of you who have had some physics. So if I have a loop, a ring, and I have a magnetic field that is passing through that ring, and let's say that I had an electric current that gets generated by the magnetic field passing through that ring, Which way is the current going to go? But if I already have the magnetic field, then we use the right-hand rule to say that you point your thumb in the direction of the field, and then your fingers tell you which way the current's going to go, correct? Is that correct?
Well, you curl your fingers with the magnetic field, so then the current
should
be this way.
So coming around this way, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But then doesn't that count cause a countercurrent to be generated as well? That if we're pointing along the direction of the current, then that's going to cause a magnetic field that's going to counter it somehow, induced by the fact that you're in that magnetic field? Which, when it does, on the outside of the compound, then the magnetic field adds to the external magnetic field. On the inside, that magnetic field is in opposition. Yes. What is what? The red arrow is showing the direction of the current that's induced. So if this is... So the current should be flowing around the other direction. So, right. I guess I'm going to have to go up and read back over my physics. The point of this is that if we're sitting here not able to discuss this, how likely do you think it is I'm going to ask you how the following occurs on a quiz or an exam? It's just illustrative of how much, I mean, you learn all this physics and math and everything else, and if you don't use it, you lose it. I'm an example of that, because of course there was a time where we were all doing this in our exams and we knew exactly what we were talking about. Point is, this situation, however it gets created, does occur. There is what is known as a ring current that gets generated in benzene, because benzene is this conjugated system, so it's like a little itty-bitty molecular wire of electrons that, because they're in a circuit, can be made to flow around. And once you put benzene into a magnetic field, it does cause a ring current, but the ring current causes its own magnetic field, which on the outside of the compound adds to the magnetic field that the hydrogens are already experiencing. Well, if you have that occurring where you have your own local magnetic field that is adding to the external magnetic field, then that's going to cause a higher chemical shift, because an increased magnetic field causes an increased energy gap, causes an increased frequency of absorbance, which is chemical shift. So that's why benzene has hydrogens that are in the 7 to 8 region, because of this effect of the fact that it's got a ring. So when benzene is placed in a magnetic field, a ring current is generated, which causes a local magnetic field to form, that opposes the external field on the interior of the benzene ring, but as adds to the external field on the exterior of the benzene ring. This means that hydrogens, which are on the exterior of the ring, experience a greater overall magnetic field, and so they have higher chemical shift. Pull this back down just a bit, because now if we've established that there's a benzene ring present, what's the structure of the compound? So take just a minute or two, see if you can use the information provided, including the fact that I'm telling you we got a benzene ring, and see if you can come up with the structure of the compound.
Benzene with ethyl?
Benzene with what? Benzene with an ethyl group, that's one suggestion. There's orthoxylene. And really there's only two other possibilities, metaxylene and paraxylene. That's the only way you could put two carbons on a benzene ring. Either not on the same place, so not an ethyl group, which the only other possibility means two methyl groups. If you have two methyl groups, then it could be orthometa or para to each other. Or the last possibility is to have both carbons in a chain on just one position of the ring. So let's look at those four possibilities. So we have ortho, meta, para, and ethyl. How many types of hydrogens do we have on the first compound? Okay. One. Two. What about the second compound? One, two, three, four. Last compound, what would be the splitting for the methyl group? It'd be a triplet. And what would be the splitting for the methylene group? Quartet. There are only singlets in the compound. So that means it has to be paraxylene. Why? Because since the molecule is completely symmetric, all four of the hydrogens on benzene are identical. And then the two methyl groups, because of symmetry, are identical. So, yes. And therefore, three dots. So we've seen ketone and aldehyde examples we got on Tuesday. We saw one little alkyl halide example, just to show us a few more tricks of analysis. We've seen benzene, and there's two things to take away from this. One, that depending on your substitution pattern on benzene, you are going to have different numbers of hydrogens possible. That last compound, if we counted, there actually would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different signals that would be generated. Let me write that in. So for benzene, we could use the number of signals and the splitting to try to figure out what the substitution pattern is. And also, benzene has high chemical shift and high degree of unsaturation. So if you see a problem that has stuff in the 7 to 8 range with a high degree of unsaturation, normally a very safe guess is to jump and say benzene. Now what we'll do on Tuesday is we'll see alcohol, ether, and alkene examples, depending on how much time we have to get through them all. Any last questions before I let you wrap up with our labs, though? So same order of priority, the current lab, the Diels-Alder lab, give priority to it. If you're waiting in a line for an IR, or if you're still trying to isolate materials and you have time, go back and do more melting points. But it looked like most of you had gotten most of the melting points done. So then the very few of you that might still have Wittig or Greenyard work that you need to do, try to finish that off.